On this episode of Skeptico.
One of the things that surprised me, and you've kind of touched on it, is the playfulness of it sometimes. Because, you know, the near-death experience, again, we kind of break it down and talk about it either medically, or then people talk about it in this kind of hyped up spiritual sense, you know, of this great, immense, you know, connection with spirit and love. And hey, that's in your accounts too. But the other thing that comes through in your accounts is, like you're saying, just the playfulness. Hey, I'm going to Las Vegas. Hey, we need a fourth for the golf tournament. What the heck is going on there? What does that say about this other realm and how maybe we ought to feel about it?
It's so true. One of the stories I loved was from Carol, and it was the account of her last words of her father, who was a roofing contractor. And she said, he would awaken and look over at me and smile so big. And he told me, oh, they have all these kitchenettes over there. There were miles of miles of them, and he would be helping build them all. You know, so it is. There is a sense of almost joy and wonder and awe, and not always. I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat the experience of dying, because there are people who also, you know, their last words are, help me, and that's real too.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today, really interesting interview. Lisa Smart, who is a linguist from master's degree in Berkeley, has written this book, Words at the Threshold. And for this book, she collaborated with famous Raymond Moody, who kind of started the whole near-death experience thing way back. And what they looked at was the words that people say when they're about to die, in and around the time that they're dying. So you've heard of like terminal lucidity, and maybe you've heard of just some profound things that people say before they die. There's tons of these. Almost all of us have family stories of this kind. So she's taken a kind of disciplined, methodical look at what's being said, and it's just fascinating. It has huge implications for near-death experience, but also obviously for science and this question of the afterlife and consciousness, and particularly what I'm interested in, you know, what is the nature of these extended consciousness realms? I think she raises some questions about that as well. Here's my interview with Lisa Smart. Today we welcome Lisa Smart to Skeptico. Lisa's a linguist whose experiences with her dying father led her to this fascinating investigation into the unique communication that often happens when people are near death. She's just written a new book about this titled Words at the Threshold, What We Say When We're Nearing Death. Lisa, welcome to Skeptico, and thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, this is exciting. It's kind of new stuff. It's going to be very much in the vein of other stuff we've talked about. But, you know, the twist on it is that you're a linguist, which I got to say, when I first heard that, I go, yeah, I know what a linguist is. And then I thought, and I go, no, I don't. I don't know what a linguist is. What is a linguist?
You know, I think a linguist is someone who's been trained in and is curious about the science of language. So many of us go ahead and we speak and we speak with people, but we don't think much about the patterns of language. And oftentimes, too, we don't think about language that might frighten us or baffle us. We just, if we hear nonsense, for example, if someone says something that makes no sense to us, oftentimes we just disregard it. But I was trained as a linguist that every bit of language is fascinating and worthy of study. So part of what I brought to this research is my training in analyzing language in terms of patterns and themes, and approaching all language with a sense of curiosity and wonder as a scientist would with any natural phenomena.
Yeah. It's really an interesting angle, because when you think about it and you really talk about it in that way, you kind of see where this language thing touches so many areas of science that we don't really think about. But then when you think deeper, you go, oh yeah, that is kind of curious. I mean, whether it's psychological or medical, or I mean, there's probably just educational. There's so many different ways. And then you've turned your lens to this near-death communication, communication that happens right before death. And it's a fascinating, fascinating way to look at it. So there's a ton of ways we could approach this. You know, we could look at it from, and you hit all of these in the book. The book is quite comprehensive. So we can look at it from the standpoint of evidence of an afterlife. We can look at it from a grieving and what it means about the grief process, how it ties into near-death experience, or we can, you know, break down the details of this communication like you do in your book. But there's also some great, great little stories in the book. Mm. But where I thought we might start is just with the story of your dad. I mean, he sounds like quite a character.
He was a character. And, you know, you had mentioned earlier about how the study of language overlaps and connects with so many other aspects of study. And when I first heard changes in my father's language at end of life, I had never imagined that I would be someone who would then be talking about the afterlife. I mean, as a linguist, it was something I never anticipated. What happened with my father is he was a PhD psychologist, very rationalist based, you know, someone who believed that this was it, you know, and he used to joke and call himself a gastronomical Jew, which to him meant that his idea of God was, you know, corned beef sandwich and coleslaw on the side with a cream soda, that he didn't believe anything beyond this. So one of the things that happened as my father was dying the last 3 weeks, he started talking about seeing angels. And that just completely blew me away because he had never spoken that way before. And he didn't have any kind of quote supernatural or otherworldly belief. So that was part of what began my interest in writing down everything he said.
Lisa, let me ask you this question. So at this point, did y'all know your dad was going to pass? I mean, was it in that kind of situation?
In what happened the last 3 weeks when I started hearing about the angels, for example, we knew. But the very first event that occurred where we didn't know that he was entering the dying phase was midnight on one night. He walked out the front door in his underwear. And January night, believe me, this was uncharacteristic of my father. And he was getting treatment for prostate cancer, but there was no indication that he was going to be dying. That's a pretty common procedure. But there he started walking down the streets, busy streets of Berkeley, California, and he started talking to the police about looking for the big art exhibition. He had to bring boxes. Well, of course, the police were concerned and brought him home, and we were baffled because my father, his whole life, helped my mother, who was an artist, bring boxes to our art exhibitions, but obviously there was no art exhibition, and there were no boxes in his hands.
Had he been suffering from any kind of dementia before that or anything?
Not at all. Not at all. He was still actually working part-time the week before. He was getting treatment, as I said. And I think, you know, he had some mild medications. And at first we thought, oh my God, it must be the medications. But what I came to find out, and I wrote down everything he said that night because my imagination was piqued. I, as a daughter, of course, I was saddened. As a linguist, I was like, wow, what's going on here?
Really, really? I mean, at this point, did that kind of linguist part of you kind of kick in that early and say, what's going on here? Which is great. I mean, I think that's really cool.
That's a great question. I think because of who I am, that when something scared me or baffled me, my first place I would go was language. That's just who I am, right? And I don't think at that point I knew I was going to be studying final words per se, but I wrote them down in my journal because I was curious about what was happening and also frightened, right? This was my father, who was an intellectual and so articulate and lucid for all his life and even the week before. But we came to find out later on that actually the announcement of a big event, like my father announcing the big art exhibition, is actually a very common pattern in the language of the dying.
Well, there's a bunch of patterns in that story. Yes. That turn out to be important. I mean, the metaphor is something that happens over and over again, and events in their life that are kind of brought in. I mean, yeah, it must have been like unsolving a mystery then as you go into it, because you start in your research. And
yeah, absolutely. And this is what's so remarkable about when we approach something metaphysical in a scientific or relatively scientific way, because when you start looking at the data and you start looking at patterns, well, we may not have all the answers for why things happen, but we can't deny that they do. And so, for example, one of the things you had mentioned is this idea of a signature metaphor, that there are certain symbols and metaphors that come up in the language of those who are dying. And in my father's case, was the art exhibition, which was an important part of his life with my mother. And Jeffrey Holder, who was a dancer and choreographer, his very final words were, before he took his very last breath, were, arms, 2, 3, turn, 2, 3, swing, right? So it's remarkable. We do seem to die as we live, that we bring those symbols and metaphors of our lives into our final words in very, very many cases. And those signature metaphors appear as we talk about a large event that's coming up. Some people will start talking about a dance or a big dinner. There were several transcripts of the big golf game.
Right, right.
And poker games. So it's really fascinating. So it's just one of many aspects of the language of end of life.
So, and I'm sorry, I kind of maybe sidetracked it a little bit, because the story gets more and more interesting. Your dad gets closer to passing and the communication changes a little bit or deepens. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you want to say, characterize it, but it does fit into what the book is all about. But then actually afterwards, that whole series of events kind of spawns this whole project that you got into, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's exactly what happened. He started speaking in nonsense. And for example, he said things, my modality is broken, or introductory offer, store is closing for food and goods. And I wrote that down and then noticed he started repeating himself. And one thing that really caught my ear was he said to his secretary on the phone, Alice, this is very interesting. I've never done this before. And this was 2 days before he died. And I thought, what is this? What is this, Daddy, that you're talking about? Why didn't he say dying is very interesting, right? Was it because he was afraid to use the word? Or was it that there was something else going on that didn't have a word for his experience? So, and then a few days before he died, he said, enough, enough. The angels say enough. And 3 days later, he was gone.
That little twist there plays another important part into this larger story and pattern. And this very confusing metaphysical part of this is precognition. I mean, here's a guy who not only now is talking to the angels and reporting back what the angels say, which is an important part, but he's predicting his death accurately. He's having a precognitive event here and saying, 3 days, I'm going to go.
I know. And it just, again, those 3 weeks with my father, on one hand, I was a grieving daughter, of course. And on the other hand, I felt like I had to enter a completely new territory and world. And it was even more startling just because of who my father was. I mean, he was someone who rolled his eyes when he heard the word angel, right? So that was even more compelling when I heard those things from him.
Okay, so this happens, your dad passes, and you feel this is percolating in the back of your mind. And then it's also kind of, you know, interesting, synchronistic in a very small way. I don't want to exaggerate it, but you meet Raymond Moody. And at the time, you don't even realize, but Moody is really, really interested in exactly the stuff that you're looking into, right?
That's exactly right. And I had read Moody's book when I was 17, and I was very intrigued by it. So when I went to go to his workshop, because I was trying to figure out what was, I wanted to know more about final words, he had spent 40 years researching unintelligible language. And it was actually his first field of interest when he got his PhD in philosophy. He was very interested, like, in the nonsense of Lewis and Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, for example. So it was actually his interest in unintelligibility that brought him to the near-death experience. And what happened is when he was a young medical student and he already had a PhD in philosophy where he specialized in nonsensical language, he heard from his patients who died and returned this language that was almost like Alice in Wonderland. They would say things like, I never felt as alive as when I was dead, or it felt like 1 minute, but also a million years when I had my afterlife experience, or people communicate, but they don't talk. Well, Raymond heard all these nonsensical descriptions and he started writing them down from these people who died and came back. And from that evolved the characteristics and the qualities of the near-death experience. And so when I heard that, I was really, really stunned to know that intersection between language and the transpersonal study of death and dying. And so we just started speaking. And a few months later, I decided that I wanted to study with this man and work with this man. And I left behind California. I packed up my Mustang with my husband. And all our kids were already out and off to colleges. So we drove to Georgia and I studied and worked with Dr. Raymond Moody, which is one of the biggest honors and privileges of my life.
Again, amazing. I mean, you're kind of condensing it down into a nice little story. But when somebody breaks that down and think about what that must have been, I mean, that's a huge, you know, life shift for you. And also there's an interesting little synchronicity there. I mean, how you even come to, you know, you have a friend who says, oh, you're interested in that stuff. You know, I know Raymond Moody is teaching this class and you ought to go. And, you know, and then you go and you just kind of, you get this book from him and you don't really say a lot, I guess, there, but then you go back and you really, you know, dig into it. And then you kind of, I mean, it's quite a story.
It, you know, I thank you so much for appreciating it. It has been, for lack of a better word, magical, because
yes,
it's been synchronicity after synchronicity occurred. And when that happens in your life, no matter what it is, you almost feel you've got to follow it. You know, it's almost like turning away from a blessing to not follow it. So, you know, yes, I left a really great secure job in Napa, California, one of the most beautiful places, you know, anywhere. I had a great job. And, but I just felt called to do this. And I'm very glad I did. I have no regrets, but you know, I went through my savings because, you know, Raymond and I did not get any major grants or anything to do this work. It was really a labor of love, but I have absolutely no regrets. It was a wonderful experience. And I'm very grateful. I have a terrific husband who was willing to, you know, take the leap with me and do it.
That's great. And, you know, Raymond Moody, people know and recognize as being the person who really brought the whole term near-death experience into our collective consciousness and kind of coined it, if you will. But he's an interesting bird, too.
I mean,
I mean, I've interviewed him a couple times and I'm always kind of torn between, you know, what's going on with this guy? Is he shooting straight with me? I mean, he talks in riddles a lot of times.
True.
And then, but also I've left conversations with him and I've told people this and I've told it on the air that when I reflect back, there are like these nuggets of deep truth,
yes,
that just kind of come through. You know, one is the nonsense thing. I mean, I can verify what you're saying. He's been harping on that for years, for years. And the other is just saying, you know, I remember him saying, well, you know, this whole study is pre-scientific. You know, and I was like, wait a minute. You know, Raymond, we're trying to bring credibility to this. We're trying to say that science is it. And how true is it to say, you know, we're looking at the whole frickin' thing backwards, you know?
Yes.
And if we are looking at it backwards, of course it's pre-scientific because science is backwards. It's looking at the result and we're looking at the larger reality, perhaps. And he never goes so far as to say those kind of things. He just says it's pre-scientific and then you have to figure out the riddle and figure out that what that means. Or he says it's like you say, it's nonsense. And then you have to figure out the riddle and figure out, well, it's nonsense because this reality that we're in is nonsense, you know, in a way that we don't understand. You know, I mean, there's some, again, it's just a riddle kind of paradox thing, I think, with Raymond a lot of times.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things he talks about is in traditional conversation, this goes way back to Aristotle, right? Everything has one-on-one meaning. For example, if I say this is a cup, I'm holding in my hand a teacup here, we both know, we agree that there's one meaning that corresponds with cup. But when you get into nonsense, or in even metaphor, there are multiple, you start dealing in the realm of multiple meanings for things. So let me be more specific. You know, a cup is a cup. But if I were to say to you, Alex, your heart is like an overabundant cup. Well, many people would interpret that in different ways. Some people might say, oh, he's so drippy, right? Overabundant cup. The guy is just, you know, or they might say he's full of love and caring. But when you have metaphor, language that's not literal language or nonsensical language, then when my dad said my modality is broken, well, you and I could sit around for years and try to figure out what the heck that means. But you and I agree that cup is cup. So one of the things that Raymond would say is that our this dimensional reality, this literal, you know, this world we live in is based on one-to-one correspondences, right? And, but what if really there are realities or dimensions, a way of seeing things such as the dream world? You know, you could have a dream that has symbols that might mean something different to me than it means to you. So in dream time, for example, there are not those one-on-one correspondences, right? It's different. So Raymond would maybe say, well, how do we know that this is a reality of one-to-one correspondences? Well, you know, honestly, Alex, I'm a pretty grounded person. So when Raymond starts talking that way, I'm like, you are a philosopher. I admire you. I admire you for that. But, you know, really for me, when I did the final words work, what I loved about it was actually pretty grounded, because when you have sentences and people say things, that seems very, and you write them down, that's pretty real. But Raymond's perspective on things is remarkable. And one of the first things, he is truly a mentor to me, but we had one disagreement early on, and I came to see that he was right. But our disagreement was this. When I first started doing the final words research, I said, don't we need to control for medications, right? I mean, maybe people are saying goofy things and we have to figure out what medication they're on, because maybe certain meds make people say goofy things, right? He said, no, we're not going to do that, because what we want to do is see what patterns emerge across all medications and diagnoses. And he was right, because we didn't control for meds, and yet the patterns organically emerge no matter the medications or what the illnesses were. So I learned to trust Raymond. I learned to think whenever I thought, oh, no, Raymond, I really learned to trust his instincts over time. And he's been a great mentor and guide.
Awesome. And that's brilliant. And you made a brilliant point there that I want to make sure we highlight. You say in the book, the investigation is not formal or rigorous. That is, it doesn't control for medications or illness. I offer a detailed explanation informed by hospice professionals, blah, blah, blah. You know, back to the thing about Raymond, it's funny you tell that story, because it does fit in with my experiences. When you reflect on it, there is a deep wisdom that he has there. I've been looking at this near-death experience thing for a long time. And one of the common knocks on it from the medical community, who just really doesn't want to deal with any of this stuff at all, is they say, oh, well, look, you can't rely on that. I mean, this person was drowning. I mean, this person had a completely different experience. They were in a coma. This person had cardiac arrest. This person had anesthesia. And then you say, yeah, that's the point.
Right.
How did they all have the same experience if they had completely different physiological medical conditions? And that's what I think you've done here. When you say the investigation is not formal or rigorous, well, in one way, maybe that's true in the way that you said, but in another way, because the way you did it, it again brings to the front this question of, Well, then how would you explain that this person, like you said, you're grounded in, and this comes through in the book. We're going to talk a little bit in a minute about the methodology you went for compiling all these accounts, which is pretty amazing. And there's like 1,500 of them in the book. But then they speak in terms of the patterns you found, speak then transcending illness, transcending age, transcending all these variables that someone could throw at it and say, oh, well, yeah, that's just dementia. Oh, really? Well, in this case, there's a completely different medical background. Oh, well, that's probably medications. Oh, really? Here's a younger person that did. You know what I mean? It really does that.
Yes. And that was, and again, I was surprised because when I first began, I looked at Raymond sort of from the corner of my eye, like, really? Really, doc? And he was like, let's just give it a try and see what happens. And he, you know, as you said, he was right. And it was from his experience with near-death experiences that led him to encourage me to move in that way.
So Lisa, tell folks a little bit how you went about compiling all these accounts.
You know, I first approached hospice and they were very protective. The scientist in me, I first had this image of like, I'm going to go bedside with digital recorders and get the words of the dying. Well, I learned very, very quickly that first, that's such a sacred and private time. And hospice, understandably, really did not want someone, a stranger, not being affiliated with the university and being under the guidance of what's called an IRB that controls ethical scientific research. You know, they didn't just want some person coming in and doing that. And I got to fully understand how inappropriate that would have been for so many reasons. And I'll say more about that later. But what I did do is I spoke to families and loved ones and asked if they'd be willing to transcribe their loved ones' words, and they could pick and choose which ones I would get, because for those very private conversations, of course, people want to keep those private, right? But so people did share those, and then I was bedside for some of them. I had chaplains and hospice workers and nurses share things with me. I spoke to other professionals in the field of linguistics and psychology and neuroscience. So I really did a range of types of information gathering. And then I have the Final Words Project, and we have a submission form where people can go ahead and submit their accounts. And then I followed it up with phone calls just to make sure that people were credible. And you know, I just wanted to make sure the data I was getting was coming from credible sources.
Tell folks a little bit more about the online submission and how that played into it, because that's still up and going, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I want to keep collecting data for as long as I can. It just basically, it's a form where you give your consent and we do ask questions about meds and just as simple, you share what you want to share and what you feel comfortable sharing. And I don't share it with anybody. You make a choice whether you want to put your name or not. And I just have gathered some wonderful stories. Last week, I got a story from someone who talked about her loved one who was right at the edge of dying and was going through a difficult period right before passing. And she started talking about the mama train. She wanted to get on the mama train. And this woman started sharing with her, let's go on the mama train. Let's go on the mama train, and just entered into her loved one's world. Anyway, that's a sort of an example of an account I got last week. And I get several accounts every week now. And I'm honored to get them from people when I do. And we really appreciate them, of course.
So let's pick up on the mama train kind of thing, because this gets into the bulk of your research and the thing that people will find, I think, challenging and fascinating. But at the same time, I mean, we all know this stuff is real, because we all have either direct experience or, you know, at least somebody in our family has been around somebody who's died and has said things that seem profound, and they may be metaphorical or they may seem nonsensical, but at some point they seem profound. I mean, give us a sense for the kind of communication that people are having.
Great. Well, just to wrap up a little bit about my dad, as I mentioned before, you hear a lot of talking about a journey. You know, the yellow bus, the yellow bus, the yellow bus is full of angels, the yellow bus, or talking about the train coming or needing a passport to go to another country. So a lot of metaphors around travel. My father said, let's get the oxygen tank. I have to get to Las Vegas. He loved to gamble. So that was his travel metaphor. But you see metaphors. You also see a lot of repetition that occurs. Beautiful, so beautiful. It's all in one piece. It's all in one piece. It's all in one piece. What you see in different pieces, it's all in one piece. So you see a lot of repetitive language. You also see something that I call sustained narratives, where someone will start a story, let's say 2 weeks out. They begin talking about the train is breaking down, or there's the boxing champ is walking into my room, or there's a woman in blue who just came by. They'll start a story, but it evolves over the days or weeks that they're dying. And it's remarkable to me that someone might start a story about the train that's having trouble leaving the station, maybe December 1st, and then December 15th, well, now the train is pulling up to the station. And then December 20th, they're talking about coming up to the platform and the people waiting for them. So you'll hear these remarkable stories evolve. Even though someone's brain is technically dying, it's remarkable that a story can be sustained over time. So you see that. You see non-referential language, which I mentioned to you a little bit when my father said, I've never done this before. It's when it's not clear what the reference is. So you'll hear things like, it's not what you think, or it's lovely, or it's all a hoax, which was Roger Ebert's.
Yeah, it's all an elaborate hoax.
Amazing final. Too bad, I can't tell you of this. You also hear something called that I call prepositional shift, where people talk about their place in space and time in unusual ways. I got to go down there. I have to go down. Or I'm on top now, moving on top. I'm crossing up. You also see something I call hybrid nonsense, where one part of the sentence refers to something going on in this world, you know, in this reality, but then something refers to something we don't see. For example, please massage my feet, honey, so I can get down into the rabbit hole. So there's no real rabbit hole, but there are real feet, right? Get my camera. I need to take a picture of this. They left the ladders, but the ladders are too short to go up there. So someone was referring to the ladders outside their window, but they needed the ladders to, quote, get up there.
It really is literally like they are in two worlds. I mean, they're stepping into one world, it would appear, and they're reporting on that in the best they can, and then they're stepping back in this world. I mean, that's one of the ways to, guess, interpret it, right?
Absolutely. And many hospice nurses whom I spoke with spoke of it that way. And they said the difference between hallucinations when people are taking drugs is that they don't have that ability to move in and out between the two worlds. So one of the things I heard reported a lot is people would be having conversations with the unseen, relatives that may have died before. For example, one woman described how her father was saying, oh, it's Earl. And that was the father had passed on. And then the mother was going back talking to this unseen father. And yet then she would say to the daughter, oh, I'm feeling much better. Earl is with me. So she had consciousness and awareness that her daughter was there. However, in cases where people have hallucinations related to drugs, the hospice nurses told me there wasn't that same sense of being able to move in and out.
You know, that's kind of interesting because you kind of hit us with a lot of different bits and pieces of this communication. But what you do in the book, and again, this is the linguist part of it that's really intriguing, is you've really structured it, deconstructed it, broken it down in ways that makes it hard to kind of dismiss one way or another. Like you said about meeting of beings, you know, which is another kind of common aspect of this. Or the journey is another aspect of it. Friends is another aspect of it. And then metaphor, you know, so each chapter in the book kind of looks through a different lens as a linguist in terms of what we're to make of this communication. How did that all shake out for you in terms of figuring out how to deconstruct all this language?
Yeah, well, the first part of it was remarkable to me. You know, in the old school, when people would do photographs in the photo lab and they just had these chemicals and they would put something in and then suddenly the pattern would emerge of the photograph. And I had that feeling with this language because I collected it and suddenly these categories to me merged very organically. I mean, it just made so much sense. And then when I started interviewing people and the connections, so for example, I interviewed Madeline Lawrence, who did research with coma survivors, and 70% of them reported that while they were in a coma, they could remember something, that there was some consciousness for them during an experience when it seemed they were completely unresponsive and not connected in any way to themselves or the external world. So when I started interviewing people and hearing these stories, and many of them were related to the medical profession. I mean, they weren't what I would think of as woo-woo. You know, just they were medically trained and scientifically trained. I just started making connections that seemed very natural to me. So, for example, there's a psychologist team. They did research on the communication of infants and parents. And they found that there were these kinds of connections that seemed almost telepathic, like how parents knew what the needs of their infants were. So I began to just ask questions out of curiosity. Could it be that we start out telepathically? Because when I interviewed near-death experiencers, they described a language of the afterlife that's telepathic. So, you know, you start seeing patterns, and all I do in a lot of the book is ask questions and pose questions as I look at possible connections between things. But the language and the data, you can't, that just exists, right? That just exists.
You know, you mentioned the near-death experience, and I kept reading it and going, wow, you know, this is a whole area that opens up a lot of new research topics for near-death experience researchers. The one being that a lot of these are near-death experiences.
Right.
A lot of these are, you cannot escape that. From what we know of near-death experiences, and we've compiled a lot of them at this point, and we've done a lot of analysis of it, and a lot of it stops in this kind of medical realm of, is the brain, what state is the brain in? And, right. You know, were they able to perceive the sock on the doctor? But all those near-death experiences, a good percentage of them also transcend into this other realm, and then they bring back these accounts. Well, that's exactly what's going on here. And it took me a while to catch on to that. But hey, these people are saying, some of them are saying, I went to the other side and I brought back this. I love this quote. One person says, and of course, our world, the one we're living in now, is three-dimensional, but the next one definitely isn't. I mean, this is a near-death experience, right? They've gone over to the other side. They've gotten some knowledge. They've brought it back, and they're communicating it. What does that say for near-death experience research?
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I noticed when I interviewed near-death experiencers as to get a bigger picture of final words, and Raymond talks about this as well. With near-death experiencers, they all say that their experience is ineffable. This is universal, that there are no words for what they went through. And so what they need to do often is lean on metaphors to try to explain what happened to them. Anita Morjani, in her book, she spoke about how metaphor is the only way that she could explain what it was like to have an afterlife experience. And she talked about a complicated warehouse. It was like going to a warehouse with a searchlight and so forth. And so we hear that a lot of near-death experiencers have to turn to metaphor to try to describe their experience. So there we are. We've got metaphor. We've got the ineffable, like the this, we hear in the language of the dying, that non-referential, that or the it is. And then we hear from near-death experiencers, as I mentioned earlier, that the language is often paradoxical, like I never felt as alive as when I was dead, for example. And we hear that from people who've had near-death experiences that it's telepathic, that their communication is like heart-to-heart or mind-to-mind, but there's no spoken language. And you see traces that that might be happening as people are approaching the threshold. So I think there's a tremendous amount of overlap between the two, indeed.
You know, one thing that just keeps popping up for me again and again, and I don't know how you wrestle with this, but it's what I like to call the how can this be question. Because obviously your research in the book, it's awesome, inspiring for a lot of people. It's going to be extremely healing, you know, for people who have gone through a grieving process. And like I said, I think it also is groundbreaking, opens up a lot of new areas of research.
Thank you.
But the thing that keeps coming back to me is it really isn't surprising in a sense. I mean, we have all heard these stories. The right. Big rub comes between when we then look to our medical establishment. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in this. We look to science and academia. They're not only not interested in it, but they seem to be aggressively hostile to it. I mean, I can't imagine what would happen to you if you went back to your UC Berkeley friends and told them, oh, by the way, all that stuff we learned about the relationship between the brain and language and all that stuff, well, it's really, really incomplete because we all have this telepathic link and talking to spirits, you know. I mean, well, there is this big divide that we kind of manage, but it is problematic, too, for people who want to approach it from a more logical, rational kind of way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, and it's said to me, it seems so unnecessary. I mean, I don't understand why this divide exists, because I had thought about possibly going back for my doctorate to do this research. And as I researched possible schools, I couldn't find a place that really received my curiosity.
Oh, forget it.
Yeah, but I'm stunned because I don't think of myself as being a particularly, I don't know, I think of myself as being relatively grounded. And this doesn't seem like that. I don't know. These are questions that just seem to open doors. And one of the things I love that Raymond talks about is skepticism, which goes back to the ancient Greeks, was really more about the ability to keep reformulating your questions as you get more information. And it's really a shame because, you know, I know that there'll be other people, or I imagine there'll be other people who will do research after my research here, which is just a first step, that might contradict things that I say, might expand upon things that I say. But that excites me because that's in the spirit of true inquiry, right? And it's really a shame to me that there is so much dogmatism on both sides, you know, in spirituality, everyone has an element of it. And it's just a shame because there's nothing more exciting than true inquiry there's, for me. And that's what brought me to the Final Words Project and doing what I'm doing and having this conversation with you right now.
You know, Lisa, what do you think was the most surprising part of the communication? What really kind of surprised you? And I'll tell you what it was for me in a minute, but I want to hear yours.
I think the most startling, there were a couple. One was the terminal lucidity, where someone could be completely unresponsive and then a few days before dying, come out of a coma or complete unresponsiveness and say words of reconciliation or love or guidance. And I think the most dramatic case was this gentleman who I knew is very credible, told me his mother had Alzheimer's. They had, you know, he couldn't communicate for her for several years. And then she went into a coma. And a few days before she died, she emerged out of the coma and turned to him and said, all the files you need to make sense of my financial situation are in the third drawer down in the study drawer.
Talk about lucidity, huh?
Talk about lucidity. And then soon after passed on. And something like that, I mean, how does one put that in the scheme of things? I don't know. You know, but it was that was one of several surprising things, but that was one definitely.
That's a great one.
What about you? I'm curious to hear what surprised you.
One of the things that surprised me, and you've kind of touched on it, is the playfulness of it sometimes.
Yes.
Because, you know, the near-death experience, again, we kind of break it down and talk about it either medically, or then people talk about it in this kind of hyped up spiritual sense, you know, of this great, immense, you know, connection with spirit and love. And hey, that's in your accounts too. But the other thing that comes through in your accounts is, like you're saying, just the playfulness. Hey, I'm going to Las Vegas. Hey, we need a fourth for the golf tournament, you know, or the magician, you know, all my, I mean, what the heck is going on there? What does that say about this other realm and how maybe we ought to feel about it?
It's so true. One of the stories I loved was from Carol, and it was the account of her last words of her father, who was a roofing contractor. And she said, he would awaken and look over at me and smile so big. And he told me, oh, they have all these kitchenettes over there. There were miles and miles of them, and he would be helping build them all. You know, so it is. There is a sense of almost joy and wonder and awe. And not always. I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat the experience of dying, because there are people who also, you know, their last words are help me, help me. And that's real too. Right. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to make this sound sugarcoated, but there really is a movement towards awe and wonder and a sense of humor and lightheartedness. So, It is true. And it's something that personally has touched me, because, you know, I was one of those people that before I got in an airplane, I would be, you know, breaking out in sweat and I was terrified. And I don't feel that way anymore. I mean, I don't feel afraid of dying the way I used to feel afraid. And that was one of the biggest gifts of my father's passing and doing this research.
Wow. And perhaps, I mean, it's not a leap to say that seems to be one of the messages of this communication, is to comfort us, comfort the people that they're closest to. A lot of times that's pretty direct.
Absolutely. Yeah, people say things, you know, tell everyone, this is another case of someone coming out of a coma and turning to their loved one and say, tell everyone I'm okay and I love them. Wow. You know, so there are remarkable stories. And I think, you know, obviously my small collection here of data is I really feel it's really just the beginning. There's so much more for us to find out.
There is. You know, final topic that you also bring up, which is a huge area in and of itself, but is after-death communication.
Yes.
Because again, every time you want to pin this down, and again, you've taken it from as a linguist and broken down the communication, and then throw all that out the window, because the person dies and the communication goes on. So now, you know, you can take the brain now completely out of it. You can take all the physical aspects, the sensory input, take all that out of it. And you have some just amazing numbers, which I guess I knew, but you kind of put them together there in a way. Amazing numbers on after-death communication. I mean, this is, to say it's common is like a gross understatement.
Right. This actually comes from Julia Sante's work, but 42 to 72% of people describe having communication of some kind with the dead. And then it's higher even into the, I think, high 80% for widows or widowers. And also the parents of deceased children often have very strong bonds with those who have passed. And we're hearing, I think, more and more stories. For example, Matthew McKay, who did this book, Seeking Jordan, about his murdered son. And this gentleman also was a psychologist, PhD, very rationally based, and had an experience that changed his whole ideas about the afterlife and communication. And, you know, I did not think I was going to go into the after-death communication, but there were so many people who, after they had tracked final words or shared their final word story, would also say, oh my goodness, I got to tell you, after my loved one died, my doorbell started ringing, the night that person died and wouldn't stop ringing, or alarms started going off, or light bulbs exploded. I had several accounts of people getting text messages. One gentleman described to me that the taxi company that his wife would often take to his place of work, texted him just as she was dying that they had just sent a taxi out to his place of employment. So people have synchronicities with nature, rainbows appearing. It completely surprised me to hear how many of these stories exist, and from people that, again, that you would think of as being skeptical, very grounded folks having these kinds of experiences. So I thought they were really remarkable.
Great. So again, the book, Words at the Threshold, What We Say When We're Nearing Death. It's out right now, right? People can get it. Amazon, yeah. They can also. And then your website is still up and going. If someone has a really compelling account that they want to share with the world.
Absolutely. Finalwordsproject.org, and it'll be up for many years. And there's also lots of information, too, if people want to just take a look and get to know more about the material.
Well, again, our guest has been Lisa Smart. This is fantastic work, groundbreaking work.
Thank you, Alan.
You're to be congratulated. I congratulate you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Lisa for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I'd tee up from this interview, when I hinted at it at the beginning, and that is, what does Lisa's work regarding these final words tell us about the nature of the afterlife? I think it raises some really interesting questions. I'd like to hear what you think. Of course, the place to do it, my favorite place for you to do it, is through the Skeptico Forum, which you can get through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. While you're there, you can, of course, download any of the 350 previous episodes of Skeptico as you please. Just pick out the ones you like, download them. There's a past shows section there. And then you can also connect over to the forum and connect with some of us who will be talking after the show. And I certainly hope Lisa will join us there as well. So if that's at all interesting to you, please do it. I love when people connect with me and connect with the show through the forum. If you don't, if you just want to send me an email or whatever, that's fine as well. So I have a number of shows coming up, a lot of things going on. Who knows what could be next? I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.